Sometimes events and the planning for the show come together to produce a certain critical mass and a certain immediacy and a certain urgency. And such has happened today. The show today will be devoted to a discussion with a man that we could call one of the bravest people on earth. He has seen the belly of the beast in this global war on terror. He understands why we have to be involved. And he's going to explain it to us in great detail. But on a day when we heard a former prime minister try to justify his dithering in Canadian involvement, not only in Afghanistan, in many other things, when we should be there, on a day when we heard ridiculous comments by a Pakistani tyrant, we need to remember something that Canadians seem to cherish all the time. We cherish values. We claim to cherish values. We believe we stand for something, because if a nation doesn't stand for something, it will fall for anything. Sadly, however, too often, instead of standing for values, instead of being immune from hypocrisy, all we're immune to are our own double standards. When we have leaders of the opposition that talk about discussions with groups that have said they want to murder and control the citizens of the free world, when they say that women have no rights, when they say that socialists should be jailed, when they say that trade unionists should be killed, when they throw acid in the faces of little girls who go to school, what are we going to talk to these people about? What is wrong with this country that we can't take the bin Ladens and the Wahhabis and the Hezbollahs and the Ahmadinejads at their word when they say that they want Islamic hegemony over all the world? They don't hate the West for anything we do wrong. They hate it for what we do right, which is living free. And they cannot compete on a battlefield of free ideas, and they will kill us for it, and they are killing us for it. Got it? And if we, this country, this supposed true North, strong and free, is not involved day by day on every front in mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change, we will not have social justice in this nation. It doesn't stop at our borders. We can't be Salon liberals. We can't be a G8 nation pulling out human assets, natural resources from the third world and never offering hope. We can't be a strong nation if all we have for national character is what we oppose, not what we propose. We can't be a strong nation when we have a self-doubt that is nothing more than a jealousy driven by a incomprehensible understanding of other self-belief. We don't understand why other people believe in things. And that lack of self-belief has allowed too many Canadians to cut down everybody of purpose and principle, to find any excuse to go back on the most basic commitments that a nation that is a member of the family of free nations must keep. But let there be no mistake, and our guest tonight, who I'll introduce shortly, will make it very clear that Canada will not be able to escape the reality that we are in a global conflict against an old tyranny wrapped in new cloaks. They've seen it in New York and London, in Madrid and Mumbai, in Bali and Beslan, almost in Toronto, and believe me, here in Montreal, we are not immune. If we are to be what we say we are, then it's time that we understood that as a member of the family of free nations, we were not created in order to disappear, that freedom is here to endure and flourish, that we are members of a civilization where we are the children of hope and the champions of the brave, that we will not be broken by adversity nor demoralized, and that we will carry proudly the shield of liberty and honor the swords of freedom that defend it. We'll be back in a moment to introduce our very special guest. Tonight we're devoting the show to someone who I don't think I'll be gainsaid if I say is one of the bravest men on this planet, who understands better than almost any other than a handful of what is the nature of the global war on terror, who understands also, unlike pundits in the West, that it is not a separate collection of different conflicts in different countries, that it is one fist with one purpose. And the most remarkable thing about our guest tonight is that he is one of the few people on this planet who, at great personal risk, doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk. Dr. Tawfiq Hamid was born in Egypt to a secular Muslim family, and he joined as a medical student the extremist Islamic group Jamaa Islamiya. At the time, that group's leader was Ayman al-Zawahiri, now bin Laden's number two chief lieutenant, and the man who you saw in videotapes say to the West just over a week ago, convert to Islam and we'll stop killing. Tawfiq Hamid has almost singularly unique intimate insights into the mindset of today's tyrants of theocratic terror. He used to pray with al-Zawahiri. In his studies, Dr. Hamid was learning to heal, but in his thoughts, as he says, he dreamed to die for Allah and to share in terrorist acts. He finally came to reject the hate and violence that radical Islam was fomenting within him. He became a physician and a scholar of Islamic texts. When he began to preach in mosques to promote a message of peace, he himself became a target of the very same Islamic extremists who had been his friends. They threatened his life, forcing him and his family to flee Egypt and then Saudi Arabia. As Dr. Hamid says, the powers of darkness were overwhelming, and I was forced to leave with my family just to stay alive. His mission now, in his words, is to speak out against Islamic fundamentalism, which he calls a cancer that is spreading with frightening rapidity across the globe today. A courageous as well as scholarly initiator of Islamic reform, Dr. Hamid seeks to build new thinking within Islam to overcome the hatred and violent extremism that have metastasized within his religious tradition. As he states so succinctly, in order to make love, in order to have love prevail, you must first defeat hate. He's also the author of a seminal work called The Roots of Jihad, which I recommend to everyone. It has been called by Lieutenant General Tom McInerney a brilliant book that describes our challenge. Hamid states clearly that Islamic terrorism has the support of the majority of Muslims and that Islam must be reformed to become a religion of tolerance. Today, it is a religion of intolerance. Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, we thank you for your courage and we welcome you to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be on your show.
Dr. Hamid, let's start this journey slowly.
Yeah.
How does a man, well-educated young man in Egypt, which is certainly not a country close to Western influence, come to be associated or come to even desire an extremist religious view of any kind? And what was the effect of the al-Zawahiri group and Jamaa Islamiya in Egypt? And how did that differ from the Muslim Brotherhood that was operating, still operating with great strength in Egypt?
Yeah. The first part of the question, which how I like changed from a relatively free and liberal person who was born for a secular family to become a fundamentalist who is ready to die for Allah and to do anything just to enter the paradise, happened in three steps. The first one is the fear of hell itself. The concept of hell in Islam is very powerful, and they taught it in a manner that is really frightening. When you are a child, you become frightened from the concept of hell. The second step happened when they convince you that if you didn't obey literally the word of Allah or the Prophet, you will be in this hell forever, and you will lose certainly the paradise. The third step comes when the traditional teaching or the Salafi Islamic teaching itself tells you that the only guarantee I mean it literally, the only guarantee to enter the paradise that is 100% guaranteed by Allah is to die in jihad. The verse is saying, وَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّ الَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَمْوَاتًا بَلْ أَحْيَاءٌ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ يُرْزَقُونَ, which means that you do not think that those who die for the cause of Allah, which means in jihad, are dead. They are alive now in the paradise. This is the only 100% guarantee. So the fear of hell itself was used as a power to direct us in certain direction that can reach a level really of doing suicide bombing. This is the first part of the question. The other part about the GI itself, the GI...
Before we get to that part,
yeah.
Why does a sophisticated medical student from a secular family in the open city of Cairo,
yes,
the crossroads, one of the crossroads of the world, would even be attracted? Because we found out that we see that many of the backgrounds, you know, Western journalists like to talk about root causes, except we've seen that many of the backgrounds of many suicide bombers, of many of the people in the 9/11 attacks, the London attacks, these are not people from poor families. These are people from middle class to higher families, well-educated. Yeah. How does that happen?
Actually, it happens in the medical school, especially because when we go to when we see dead bodies during dissection, we always remember death. And death is linked to a lot of fear in the mind of people in this part of the world. Fear of hell, fear of punishment in the grave. So when you see dead bodies there and you are still a student, you start to think in the second life, what is in it? And you start to have some religious way of thinking. So this was the first step. The second thing is when we learn biochemistry, physiology, and all such things, we see the power of God or Allah, and in the creation, we see the dynamics of cellular biochemistry and how the eye works and all such wonderful things in the creation. So we started to feel the power of Allah or God in the creation. So it created a combination of fear of the second life and if we didn't obey God, and extreme belief in the existence of God himself.
There is no eternal life if you don't follow it literally then.
Exactly. So
Tawfiq Hamid, please bear with us. We're going to have these breaks on every 10 minutes or so. We'll be right back with you. And we're devoting tonight's show to an intimate encounter with Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, who could be called a courageous citizen of the world, the man who left terror. Tawfiq Hamid was a member of Jamaa Islamiya, an extreme Islamic group in Egypt, that at that time was headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, now the right-hand man to Osama bin Laden. Judea Pearl, the father of murdered journalist Daniel Pearl, said this of Dr. Hamid: Tawfiq has been a constant source of inspiration to me and my family since the murder of our son Daniel Pearl by terrorists in Karachi, Pakistan in 2002. He's a most effective voice in the struggle to win the hearts and minds of young people in the Muslim world, and I consider him a true humanist and a great friend. Tawfiq Hamid,
yeah,
you described how the initial connection into extremism is based on the belief in the afterlife and the necessity of following almost a literal interpretation of the command to get everybody under the same Islamic tent. How you had intimate knowledge of al-Zawahiri is today, of course, one of the, let's call him one of the leading members of the general staff of the of the terror axis. How was he personally, and how threatening was he? When did compulsion and coercion come into play?
Actually, al-Zawahiri as a person, to be honest, he's a very nice person at the personal level. He was very decent, polite with us, and supportive, but you can tell when he talks and he was older, much older than me, 10 years, and he was like a mentor for me. When he speaks, he always speaks about how it is a real mission for us Muslims to dominate the world by the Islamic Sharia and make all this Western
Sharia Sharia, for our listeners, is, for those who don't know, is Islamic law, which in most countries functions as both religious law and state law.
Yes, exactly. So it's we use actually to hate. He made us with his talks hate the West and hate their values, especially women rights. This was a real struggle for us. We hated the concept that women wear wonderful clothes instead of the hijab, and they go in swimming, and they can work, and they created a whole system of hatred to the Western countries, and they really have such powerful ability to convince young Muslims, including myself at some stage, that we have to declare war on these, what they call infidels, to make them submitted to Islam. So it's how it went, especially the word Islam itself means in Arabic language submission. It has nothing to do with the word peace. The word peace is derived from a verb. It's called salam and is derived from the word salama, which is totally different from the word Islam, and that is derived from the verb aslama. Totally different words. So the real meaning was to make others submitted to Islam itself.
What years were these that you were involved in?
It was in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay, so here we see a picture developing in Egypt. One, what we call today, of course, has made peace with Israel, which is a frontline Western state, a center of culture. We see in Egypt, which also, however, was the home of Sayyid Qutb, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, whose writings of hate influenced so many throughout the Arab world. Before Afghanistan, because we have many Western journalists who say, well, there's been a radicalization in the Arab world since Afghanistan. The Mujahideen fought with the West to knock out the Russians. That's what caused the radicalization. Here we're talking about a situation before Afghanistan, before the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, where we already had a radicalization happening within the Islamic clerical and professional worlds.
Of course, and it at that time it was merely because you are not submitted or subjugated to the Sharia, and the hatred was for...
And that was the main thing, subjugation, submission to Sharia law, and this was around the same time we saw in the early 80s, of course, in 1981, the assassination of Sadat by Muslim Brotherhood, and indeed, there is some evidence that al-Zawahiri himself was involved and implicated in that assassination.
Yeah, I never hated the Westerners because of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Dr. Hamid, I've got to interrupt again. As we discussed earlier, there'll be these breaks. We'll be right back with you.
Okay.
Thank you. And we're devoting tonight's program to an intimate conversation with Dr. Tafiq Hamid, a man who left behind a life of terror. He had been a member of the extremist Islamic group called Jama Islamiya in Egypt that was at that time headed by Ayman al-Zahiri, who is Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. His life was threatened when he left. He has devoted his life now to reconciliation of Islam with fundamental principles of justice and freedom and tolerance. He's been described by Judea Pearl, the father of murdered American journalist Daniel Pearl, who had his throat cut and his head severed by Islamic terrorists in Pakistan, as a true humanist and a great friend. Dr. Hamid, before the break, you were explaining how the radicalization of Islam, particularly by men like al-Zahiri, occurred even before the Afghanistan war against the Soviet Union, and particularly centered on what values in the West these men found to be impossible to accept. Now, did the leaders of radical Islam, and I'll take this a step further in a few moments. Is this really a hatred of everything in the West, or are they using it as an excuse for Islamic hegemony, as they say, to restore the caliphate?
It's both. They hate these Western values very much, especially liberty and the freedom, because these values are totally against any typical Islamic system. If you see Taliban or any typical Islamic system, the first thing they do, they limit freedom of people and they limit women rights. This is the first thing they do once they are in control. So it's combination between this and the dream of having the Islamic Caliphate that controls all the world under the concepts of Islamic Sharia law.
Now,
which from
here I want to ask you something very important.
Yeah.
We have, in the West, and particularly in Canada, a great number of people who like to call themselves progressives who try to make the argument that there are root causes, that we have to understand what is happening in even what they admit are failed states, failed cultures, that they have a right to be wrong, and they try to make a differentiation between Sunni extremism, Iranian Shia extremism, Taliban, Hezbollah. But are those differentiations valid today, or are we hearing the same message, which we are in words, from all these sources, and is it a centralized message today? Is there this new alliance or this new axis that has put aside the age-old differentiation between Sunni and Shia and has said, okay, for this mission, for this holy war, we'll stand together?
Actually, all these organizations represent different faces of the same coin. The coin is what is called Salafi Islam, the typical traditional teaching. In the Salafi Islam, Muslims have to declare war on non-Muslims and put them in this situation to either convert to Islam or to pay the Muslims a humiliating tax, specific tax, while the non-Muslims are in a humiliating and subdued position, or to be killed. This is a basic fundamental teaching till now in our Islamic universities, and all these groups have this core value. And they are all the same, different faces of the same coin. They might differ in the approach. Like Islamic Brotherhood, it can accept a slow approach. Bin Laden can accept an attack or prefer to attack from now. The Iranian system have another agenda. So it's just different approaches, but the ultimate...
The different tactics, but the same strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Are they all talking together?
Yes, certainly, because they all belong to Salafi Islamism. They might differ, but when it comes to hatred of the non-Muslims or the West, they will unite in this.
Now, all these leaders, from Bin Laden to the mullahs of Iran, I won't even mention Ahmadinejad, he's a puppet of the mullahs, to Nasrallah, the Wahhabis, these are not, they may be extremists in their beliefs, but these are not unsophisticated people, and these are people with wealth and power and an understanding of the world. I want you to repeat what you said before the break when I asked you the question, do they really believe this hatred, or are they using it as a political tool for control of their societies and the control of the West as well? And if they believe it as a philosophy, how do they come to believe this as a philosophy coming from the backgrounds they do?
It's both. They hate the West and they use it also to control people. So it's a combination of both.
Do they hate the West just because of the roots of their philosophy, or as some on the left will argue, for all the terrible, quote, sins that the West has committed?
No,
against them.
One of the problems that people in the West have is that they have extraordinary ability to do self-criticism.
They like that. It's the Western. It's the Western form of self-flagellation.
But once it comes to criticizing others, they become mentally paralyzed, and that is the real problem. It's like you are trying to find the cause in yourself, and the cause is not in you. We see people in the West attacking the Crusades, saying it's wrong, but who attacked whom first? Muslims first attacked Europe before the Crusades attacked Muslims. But no one goes backward in history to tell the truth here. So we deal with a very strange situation of people who are ready to do self-criticism, but once it comes to criticizing others, they become mentally paralyzed and unable to criticize them. And this is one of the real causes of the problems, because if you don't admit the real root of the problem, you will never solve it.
Dr. Hamid, we're going to come right back, and we're going to talk about the moral relativism and the political equivalency that becomes such a poison in the West. We'll be right back. Yeah. And we're devoting tonight's show to a conversation with an extraordinary man, Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, who was in the belly of the beast. He was an Islamic extremist in Jama Islamiya, an Egyptian extremist group headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who now is Osama bin Laden's number one man. There are very few people that understand the enemy that we face right now, as Dr. Tawfiq Hamid understands it. Now, Dr. Hamid, before the break, you were explaining how at the same time that we had an increase in radicalization in the Islamic world, stemming from the 1930s and 40s, the writings of Kitab of Seed, Kitab of Muslim Brotherhood, that even supported by people like the Mufti of Jerusalem at that time, you had this expansion of extremism all the way through the 70s into the early 80s. At the same time, the West was becoming morally relativist, politically equivalent, and not being able to call a spade, to see what was happening there. Now, to address one of the issues that Western intellectuals have, that somehow the West, in some colonial manner, did this injustice in the Arab world, I want to ask you something. We know that the West, after the World War I, created the boundaries of the modern Arabic world. They found oil, they developed the oil, but at the same time, that brought wealth. And when Saudi Arabia decided to nationalize Aramco, they let them nationalize it. Oil states like Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait certainly ran their own show and have been running their own show since the late 50s and early 60s. What is it about the West that allows so many in the West to buy the argument of the Islamic extremists that some great injustice was done in the Arab world by the West on a political level?
It is the same concept that I just mentioned, that they are unable to criticize others. They become mentally paralyzed.
But this is a knowledge of history. We can understand how the Bin Ladens and the Nasrallahs sell this nonsense within the Arab world, but how is this nonsense sold in the West?
If you, for example, are unable to criticize others, while the problem is in the others, then you will always come to wrong conclusions. And this is what's happening for many Westerners. They start the whole analysis by a wrong pre-assumption. That is, the problem is related to colonization and such things, while the reality started more than 1,000 years ago when the Arabs invaded Europe under the name of Islam to force them on Islam, and this was before colonization. So the problem happens because you in the West have, not you personally, but in the West, people they want to be politically correct to the degree that they ignore facts that are crystal clear.
Is this out of fear?
It is a real fear. And
now, you stated that you were a participant in a very important intelligence summit on counterterrorism in Washington this past February.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the mindset that we need to know about these Islamist terrorists. And you've written, as I said in the introduction, that in order to make love prevail, you must first defeat hate.
Yeah.
How do we do it? Are we going about it the right way? And how long a process is this? I know we can't put an end date on it, but are we on the right road? Does it first take confrontation before we can do reconstruction?
Yes, certainly you need to work on three approaches. A military part to show the Islamists that they are defeated. This is number one. Number two, a reformation part, working on the ideological level to save the young Muslim generations from this barbaric sort of teaching, because it really changes people. I was a very innocent person. I just, like, for example, I never thought to beat my wife, for example, but when I started to follow certain forms of Salafi Islamic teaching, I thought about it. It is a crime, okay, but I never did it, but it's what happened. This sort of teaching is like cancer, and we have to deal with it exactly like we deal with cancer. Just one moment here. Our immune system has to be tolerant to every cell in our body and to accept the variants so that we can live. But once the immune system starts to tolerate cancer cells in the body, it is the end of the human body. So we have to be wise like our immune system that developed over millions of years. We can tolerate each other. We can tolerate the difference. But the moment that we realize that there is a cancerous sort of teaching, we have all to unite together and to stand against it.
It was remarkable. I said at the beginning that sometimes when we plan a show, political events coincide. There is a classified report. There is a report that was classified that will now become declassified. It'll hit the papers tomorrow. That is a consensus of 16 U.S. intelligence agencies about Jamaa Ismailia, Islamiyah itself today. And this report says that Jamaat Islamiya is now ready to expand and develop the capability for, quote, mass casualty attacks beyond their previous capabilities. And that it poses, this particular group poses a danger to the U.S. homeland almost at the same level as Al-Qaeda. What do we need to know about Jamaat Islamiya?
Jamaat Islamiya is not much different from Al-Qaeda. It's just they didn't have the power to implement their violent ideological beliefs. That is the only difference. But the moment they have this power, they will attack you, and they will attack you irrespective of your deeds. So if you didn't do the war in Iraq, they will attack you. If you did the war in Iraq, they will still attack you. It makes no difference. The hatred is because it's ideological. It has nothing to do with what you are doing. It's because you are not submitted to Islam. So as Bin Laden said it, and al-Zawahiri, you convert and become subjugated to Islamic Sharia and Islam, then terrorism will stop. So,
Dr. Hamid, I'm sorry I got to interrupt again. We got to go to a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're talking with, and have spent the last the program talking with Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, a hero of this planet, a hero as a world citizen, a man who left the belly of the beast of terror. He left an extremist Islamic group headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now Bin Laden's right-hand man, to right wrongs. He's the author of The Roots of Jihad, which I highly recommend to everyone, and he's given us a startling overview and insight into exactly what we're facing. And Dr. Hamid, please stay with us. We'll take one or two calls, if you would, before the show concludes. And I want to welcome Rachel Lipsky right now. Rachel, good evening.
Good evening.
Now, Rachel, Rachel Lipsky is an American living in New York, and you do a great deal of work bringing together people who have left extremist backgrounds, getting them together with Jews and Christians in reconciliation. The story you're hearing from Dr. Hamid as an explanation of what happens to people, is this something you've heard before?
Unfortunately not. With the people that I'm dealing with, there is so much concealing of reality because people are so much afraid of speaking about the real issues. And what happens is because of some of them have true intentions and others do not have very true intentions, but generally speaking, they are caving into this politically correctness mode, and they naturally are reluctant to face those very serious, heavy-duty, unpleasant topics. And as a result, most of us are left with very blurry, confusing messages which conceal reality, and I find it to be extremely dangerous because it only suppresses the need of Muslims themselves to speak up and of us to ask those pertinent, crucial questions.
Is it a question of denial or a question of cowardice on the part of people in the West?
Denial or what?
Is it a question of denial of reality or just cowardice on the part of people in the West?
I did not hear the second word.
Cowardice.
Oh, I think it's both. It's both. People are very fearful because they are intuitively they know that they would be they are afraid to ask the core questions. Number two, it's ignorance. People just don't know. And I think your guest is crucial in making people understanding what's really going on. I think it's both. It's fear and it's ignorance together.
I want to go back to Dr. Hamid on this point. Dr. Hamid, we're constantly told by people on the left, if we just leave things alone, if we just give in, they'll leave us alone. I want you to repeat what you said earlier. Will they leave us alone if we just turn a blind eye to what they're doing?
No, they would have done this 1,000 years ago when they invaded most of the world to force them on Islam or jizya or be killed. It is a belief system that once we have power as an Islamic nation, we declare wars on others for this purpose. The difference is that some people like the Wahhabi, for example, apply this at a nation level.
Just for our listeners, the Wahhabis are the clerical establishment in Saudi Arabia, but are in conflict sometimes with the royal family.
You can tell from the flag itself that there is a sword and above it the verse, the part that makes you a Muslim converted to Islam. So the combination of the sword just represents the Salafi teaching that they are coming by the sword or military to enforce them on their beliefs. It's just they do not have the power, but their belief system is terrible. And Bin Laden is different in that he considers it at individual level. So every individual, in the view of the jihadists, has to declare war on the West. That is why you see suicide bombing and you see such strange things happening. So the difference is only tactical, but the strategy is the same, to make you subdued to Islamic Sharia system.
So
and lose all. Yeah.
If I can draw a comparison, which is often drawn, and if I'm off base, please stop me. Just as we saw in the 1930s, German demands for control, physical control of Europe, being couched in terms of Lebensraum, living room, or being couched in terms of it's the communist fault, it's the Jews' fault. There was a parallel stream. Are we seeing an Arab nationalism that wants physical control of territory and couches it in terms of we also will make you pure by destroying the horrible things in the West, like freedom and women's rights and everything else? Is that parallel a valid parallel? On geopolitical terms.
Very valid. And the other valid part in the story is that when Winston Churchill said to Chamberlain, who thought that peaceful negotiations can end the problems with the Nazi in Europe, for example, when he said to him, you had a choice between war and dishonor, and you chose dishonor, and you will get war. And that is the reality here. If you didn't confront the reality of Islamism, it will confront you.
Tafiq
Hameen, many
thanks for your courage. Many thanks for taking the time to be with us. Rachel Lipsky from New York, thanks very much. Montreal, Canada, everybody listening, just remember these words of John Philpott Kern, an Irish statesman of the 19th century. The condition upon which man hath received liberty is eternal vigilance, which condition, if he break, servitude is at once the consequence of his crime and the punishment of his guilt. Nick Mays, thank you, and Master Control. We'll be back tomorrow night.
Thank you.